Outdoor Edge introduces the all-new Razor Guide Pack. Coming in at 12 ounces and in a premium wax canvas roll pack for compact storage and travel, the Razor Guide Pack is 7 blades in total, including a 5-inch replaceable blade folding knife, a 3-inch replaceable blade caping knife, and the flip and zip saw for wood or bone. Whether you're hunting the back 40 or chasing game deep in the backcountry, the Razor Guide Pack has it all. For more information, visit OutdoorEdge.com.
The truth on the Houndsman XP Podcast Network is fueled by Joy. Joy Dog Food has been in business for many decades, since the 1940s. They've never had a recall. They only use 100% American-made products to bring you a dog food formula that is going to keep your hounds on their feet and performing at a high level. Late round bound, the next bear race, the next cat race, whatever you got going, Joy can keep your dog fueled up. I personally feed Joy for this reason. They are not afraid to get in the trenches and get in the fight. They will show up at a local meeting where people are trying to pass tethering laws or breeders' bills or whatever, and put their name on that and put their reputation on the line to support us. So find Joy Dog Food on the internet. Find that dealer locator. Find a dealer near you. Go to joydogfood.com and keep those hounds fueled by Joy.
If it hasn't aged, the moonshine's never aged. They may stick it in a barrel for a month or two.
Yeah, I really like grain alcohol.
I do too, in a margarita. My buddy makes the best moonshine. Just lives not too far from here, but he's old school. Keeps it back in the weeds. No, anyway, he does. I'm not going to name his name, but he does.
I used to be able to get it out of eastern Appalachia. I'll just keep the region very broad.
Yeah,
and I still can, but. Neely's Family Distillery right across the river here. I mean, they're 15 minutes from the house, and they make one called Pop Casey's.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Did you listen to that Huberman Lab podcast I told you about?
The what? Which one?
What alcohol does to your body on the Huberman Lab podcast?
No, you never sent me the link. You were going to.
Oh, I thought I did. Yeah, I ain't gonna send it now that you're already sipping on your moonshine.
Yeah,
all right. It'll ruin you. It'll absolutely ruin your day. I only drink one drink on Sundays now. I made it through like 2 weeks of sober October. Never had a single.
I didn't know there
anything.
Was a sober October.
Well, I've never done it before, but I thought, you know, this is a good time to just shut it off for 30 days and, you know, kind of recoup. And then, that lasted till World Hunt.
Yeah.
And then next thing I know, they had a bottle of Widow Jane sitting there for like $70 and I can't find it at home. So I pick it up and got to crack it open. And that was the end of my sober October.
See, that's my deal with like high end bourbon and stuff is I like it. So, you know, I don't just have one bottle sitting. I've got to buy two. So I've got one, you know, one sitting back.
I do that a lot of times. But like I had a bottle of Widow Jane sitting here I'd never opened.
Yeah.
And then I seen another one out there and I thought, well, I'll get that one a drink, leave this one here for later, because sometimes I don't like a bottle and I'll just keep it back and do something with it later.
Have you ever drank Pendleton?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like Canadian whiskey at all.
I like Pendleton. That's the one I do like.
I like American stuff, pal. Mm-hmm. I don't, other than Heineken beer, it's not American.
So, all right. Pendleton whiskey is about as American as you can get.
It's Canadian whiskey.
It is distilled and blended in Oregon, and it's named after the Pendleton Roundup, the cowboy roundup. That didn't come
Hold
from
on.
Canada.
I'm running the Googler.
You run the Googler.
I'm doing it right now.
Yep. It doesn't come from Canada there, bro.
Why does it say Canadian whiskey on it?
It's the Canadian style whiskey.
It comes from Oregon. That's no more American than Canada.
Well, it's like probably half of that bourbon you drink isn't distilled in Bourbon County, Kentucky.
Well, yeah. I only drink Kentucky bourbon. Other than the Widow Jane, it's a New York bourbon, but I'm not a big fan of it now that I've already emptied a bottle.
That's the thing. You know, if it's going to be bourbon, it needs to come from Bourbon County with Bourbon County water.
It needs to be at least in Kentucky, in the state of Kentucky.
Yeah.
That's my theories on it.
Yeah.
My favorite bourbon is Blue Run. I've only been able to acquire two bottles in my life. And right now, the bottle that I have that is unopened, I drank one. The unopened bottle is worth 10 times more than I paid for it. And I paid $300 for it. And that run does not exist anymore. I don't know. I bet you there's only 50 or 60 bottles of those left.
See, that's the difference between, I'm not a collector. You used to go to the Ducks Unlimited banquets, and the big deal was you win a shotgun at one of the commemorative models, and the action's never been broken.
Yeah.
I never was that guy.
I don't collect much either, but there's something about something that takes that many years to make.
Yeah.
That does something, and especially there's nothing more purely American in this world than Kentucky bourbon. I mean, that's as American. That's more American than apple pie.
I've got some apple pie in the truck. It's going to Texas with me.
All right, let's get what did I text you? I texted you.
I don't know.
I said the topics were today: barking puppies.
Oh yeah.
Mountain lion sightings. And World Hunt Recap.
Oh, okay.
That's what we were going to talk about. We can talk about whatever. I could spend another 4 hours talking about bourbon, trust me.
You want to talk about crazy Yogg Terriers? Man, this sucker is funner than a barrel full of monkeys, man. He's something else.
Is he like crazy gamey like the ones we had that I've been around, or is he just...
Oh, he's pretty...
Actually, is he pretty normal, though?
Yeah, I mean...
Like, he don't just fight himself if there's nothing
else. No,
because that's what ours were like.
Before I got him, I had a friend of mine. I got to get Snyder on this podcast sometime. The guy's... He's just a walking comedy show most of the time. But he has an epic story. He thought he was going to get some Yogg Terriers, and he's got that epic story that turned, you know, it's just too funny. But I always heard they were dog aggressive and all this stuff, and maybe some of them are, but, man, he's not. He's just him and Axel, the pit bull, they'll wrestle and chase each other around the house, and the next thing you know, they're taking a nap together on the porch. Now, you got to watch them.
You got a pit bull?
Mm-hmm.
What's it like?
Atypical pit bull, I'd say. He's super chill. You see all this stuff coming out on, you know, social media right now since the devastating attack down in Tennessee, wasn't it?
Missed it.
Yeah.
What happened? Fill me in.
Two children killed, a three-year-old and a five-month-old. Mom got chewed up trying to keep the two pit bulls off of them.
That's one of the problems, is there's always more than one.
I've talked to my wife a lot about it because we do have one, and people are talking about genetics, and then the other people will say, no, it's how they were raised. Well, I mean, genetics are everything, you know.
Yeah.
Genetics make it possible to do what we love to do. But the thing of it is, I treat Axel with the respect he deserves, just like a loaded gun.
Mm-hmm.
There should be rules that any dog owner have, but especially a breed like that need to be followed. You know, they're not horses, they're not trampolines, they're not, you know, something that you can pull their ears. And I treat him, he gets on the bed every night when my wife's in there watching her iPad and crocheting. And when I come in at night, you know, I'm not yelling at him and screaming at him and running him off the bed. You know, we make a game out of it, and he gets off the bed. But it's, you know, I don't manhandle him. I don't, I know there's something in there genetically that can be a trigger just like I know there's a trigger on a shotgun, and I don't mess with it. You know, I've pushed it to see how far before, but then reading his body language and stuff, you can see it. You know, you can start to see that behavior change when it's like, I'm not going to be pushed much farther. And you know where that threshold is. And now you know where you can go and where you need to stay away. You know, it's just like handling firearms. You know, when you know people that the first time they pick up a rifle or a handgun to shoot, they're intimidated by it and they don't know how to hold it. And they don't know, for people that have been hunting as long as we have, you know, it just becomes second nature. It's an extension of our body. And that's the way I look at the pit bull. Is I think a lot of times you look at our culture, people don't know how to treat that. They don't know how to handle that. And kids are a lot of times do not have the boundaries that they need to be taught to have a dog like that. So you can't just say, it'd be cool to have one and they'll protect the family. And I've got these little hellions over here that can't sit still in a restaurant and they, you know, they terrorize everything. It's not going to work. And I'm not saying a thing about these people. I have no idea who these people are. That was tragic. It really was. But at the same time, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, you know, that issue.
As a father, I've never trusted any. I don't trust any dog. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I've been around dogs and had dogs of all breeds, most all large breeds. I've never owned a small breed dog other than a beagle in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't trust a single one of them around a toddler.
Exactly.
Or a baby.
Right.
Not a single one.
None.
Never in a million years would I leave a large breed dog or a medium breed dog around a child. Because a child doesn't know the dog's body language. A child doesn't know how a dog's going to react.
Exactly.
And those dogs are not people.
Mm-hmm.
They are not wired the same way we are. Now, we can come in and we can dress them up and put birthday party hats on them and stuff like that. But they're not us. Okay. Yeah. So these are still animals and creatures that are driven by different things than we are. They're triggered by different things than we are. Aggression and physical correction is a dog's language as long as there have been wolves on this planet.
You bet.
When an alpha wolf is in a pack, he dominates that pack through violence.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in your dog, I don't care if it's a Chihuahua or a Great Dane, that can prevent a dog can prevent that many years of DNA and genetics. There's nothing. So I don't trust any large dog around small children.
Exactly.
Now, all these ones that you see the pictures on social media where they're pulling on the dog's ear and the kid's climbing all over it, and they're like, oh, mine's just a sweet baby, and they show pictures on the couch, and it probably is. The dog's probably a great dog.
And the whole time the dog's sitting there with his ears are cocked back a little bit. He's licking his lips. You know, he's doing things like that. He not only do the kids not understand body language, the parents don't either.
No.
Because they're like, see, he's the sweetest thing ever. And the whole time he's asking nicely right now. He's like licking my lips. I'm looking out. I've got the white around my eyes. You know, my ears are cocked back a little bit. I'm telling you in my language right now that this is not a comfortable place for me to be. So, but if there isn't an adult in the room, then you're going to have problems. I don't care. Like you said, I don't care what breed it is.
And it's heartbreaking, the pedestal that they've put dogs on. And don't get me wrong, I like my dogs. I like all of them. Bogan's sitting right here next to me. I've got really nice coon dogs that I enjoy competing with and hunting and stuff. But I mean, they're not people. And we got to quit treating them as such. I don't think that's ever going to happen. It gets worse year by year.
Yeah.
You know that just as well as I do. I mean, you put a picture of a starving dog or a starving kid on the internet and see which one gets more comments.
Exactly.
I mean, it's pretty sad. But anyway, you're pit bull. Yeah. You know the rules. You know the dog. You're lucky to be a dog guy. So, and I've been around pits quite a bit. We use them as catch dogs. The ones I've been around haven't been pets. They've all been working dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But the pets I've been around have all been dogs. But they need their space.
They just want a job.
They
man.
Need what they need. Yeah.
And I was leery about this because this is the first one we had. I was in Montana working. My wife sends me this picture of this puppy. She's like, look what I just picked up from so-and-so. I'm looking at this picture of this puppy. And I was like, what have you done? Do you have any, do you know what kind of dog that is? And she's like, well, they told me what it was. I said, that's a pit bull. And she's like, you think so? And she was playing me to the max. It didn't matter that it was a pit bull to her. She liked that dog, and she was going to get that dog. And so, you know, we'd never raised one. I called all of my friends that have raised and trained, had hunting pits, you know, that they're for a long time, and just picked their brain and had a conversation with them about them, and did some research and really did up my game on like dog behavior and stuff like that, so I could gauge it and read it and stuff like that. So getting back,
I'm sure today's pit bulls out of certain stock are probably a little mellower and a little less aggressive, but you're not going to unwire all that.
Mm-mm. No,
you know, you're going to unwire some of it through 10, 12, 15 generations, but you're not going to unwire it all.
When it goes bad, it's going to go really bad.
Yes.
You know, and I don't want a Yog Terrier puppy becoming a ragdoll for a pit bull, you know, so just do what you do and make sure that you don't get there and correct behaviors and, you know, set some ground rules, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. Did I ever tell you about the time that the parenting class that I went to, this was before our first kid was born.
You went to a parenting class. Uh-huh. How'd that go?
It was with our church. My wife's like, I think we should, you know, my wife was all fired up because we were having our first baby. And she was like, I think this would be good. The associate pastor is putting on a parenting class and all these expecting parents are going to get together and they're going to have a class. And I did the typical eye roll, like, great, this ought to be, you know, like getting kicked in the nuts for an hour. And and so we go and you've got all these people and they're talking about, oh, I think when we have our baby, I'm going to be like this and I'm going to do this and I'm going to. And I just sat there. I listened to all this stuff for a long time. And Steve looked at me, the leader of the group. He said, Chris, you've been quiet. What do you think? And I said, I think raising kids and raising dogs is not that much different. You lay down the rules, you enforce the rules, and you reward good behavior and be consistent. And you're there. And these women tried to stab me with plastic forks and everything else. It was like, oh my gosh, how could you compare a child to a dog? You can tell how long ago it was now, Josh, because now you wouldn't ever get that comment.
Oh, now they're fur moms. Yeah. They have parenting classes for people with dogs that are getting ready to expect a new puppy.
Yeah, yeah. But that was always like a classic deal. My wife still reminds me of the parenting class we went to years ago where I brought up dog behavioral and dog training in our parenting class.
The only two times that I compare humans to dogs are in parenting, because you're right, it is similar. You know, you show me someone with a terrible dog, and usually their kids are brats. You know, it's usually about the same.
Yeah.
And I will say that some dogs are just born assholes.
Yeah.
And people are that's the only two likenesses. Some dogs are just born that way.
Yep.
And some people are just born that way.
Yep.
It's not all environment.
And then you got two of them that do a podcast.
Yeah, together. That's right. That's right. And I got a bunch of asshole dogs too.
The Truth is sponsored by Havoc Hunting Supply. When you are looking for high quality gear, go to the people that understand the demands you put on your gear. Havoc has a full line of top quality hunting gear that meets those demands. Rugged hunting vests for the big game houndsman to the sleek, high-speed, low-drag vest for that late round-bound competition hunter. Havoc has what you need. The Havoc website features a complete line of hunting gear for the serious houndsman, and they feature that iconic Havoc logo. Go to HavocHuntingSupply.com and order your gear today. It's time to turn the hounds loose. It's time to wreak some havoc.
Hey, one thing I did want to talk to you about is the Chris Saunders podcast.
Yeah.
I loved that. And I've gotten a lot of feedback, I imagine you have too, about some of the things that Chris said and some of the things. I think Shorty might have been one of the first ones to text me. He said, hey, send me that dude's number. He's got the kind of dogs I want. Mm-hmm. And I think Chris done a fantastic job, and I knew he would. Me and Chris have been visiting. We run into each other at the World Hunt. We sit out there in front of the clubhouse all the time, and we visit. And I haven't had a chance to go hunting with Chris, just pleasure hunting yet, but I need to. And
yeah, he said
he said some real interesting things about reproduction as far as the litters, you know, having sires and dams that come from good litters, mm-hmm. and how a dog runs a cold track and how they focus on a cold track and stuff like that. And I've always said, and I think you're kind of in this, in agreement with me here, as far as the dog's olfactory abilities are normally pretty much even par. The ability to smell certain things are different, or are the pretty much the same, but the mindset is the difference.
Their willingness to react to the odor, yes. You know, do they have the drive? Do they have the inclination to stick with it? You know, but, yeah. You know, I don't care whether it's a boxer or a coon hound. You know, when they're going to smell, we couldn't measure the difference in their ability to smell things. I'm sure somebody could, but
yeah,
you know, it's just what they're inclined to do and how much drive they have to pursue that. So, dogs knows they can both lay on the porch and smell the same thing. And the hound is going to get up and chase it. And, you know, the lap dog, probably not.
Yeah. Because Bogan's with me all the time. Mm-hmm. He's on the road with me. I let him out a million different places, rest stops, old gravel roads, everywhere. And the amount of time that dog takes to decipher things that are coming through his nose astounds me. Mm-hmm. The fact that he won't sit down and run a track, and he might. He loves chasing squirrels and stuff. But I know that he will sit there and smell where a dog peed 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And he will, especially when it's cold and you want to go back inside and you just want the stupid dog to go to the bathroom. It's 5 degrees outside. He'll sit there and smell on that post. Oh, yeah. He'll sit there and smell on that post for 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And, you know, Con and some of the other male dogs that I've packed around, they'll take a quick whiff. They'll pee on it. They'll go on. And Bogan's deciphering. He's reading that book word for word.
Yeah.
He's not a speed reader. You know, he's going through that scent. And I think when he smells a turd from a Chihuahua, he can tell what that dog ate 2 weeks ago.
Guarantee it.
You know, and he just, it's amazing how these dogs' noses work. But I just wanted to touch on that with you because we have cold nose, hot nose, all that stuff. Cold nose is just a phrase. Hot nose is just a phrase. It's yep. A cold mindset, hot mindset. That's my theory. Are you in that same boat with me?
Yeah. It's so daggone complicated to talk about. And it's just one of those, it's like the urban dictionary or the, you know, the backwoods dictionary for coon hunters, you know, cold houndsman, cold nose, hot nose. What does that really mean? We've tried to, man, I've been trying for 2.5 years to really define that and break that down to what that actually means. And it's just a difficult thing, you know. Some dogs are just more inclined to dig in and try to decipher that odor, scent, whatever you want to call it, regardless of how old it is. I think the dog, there's a really good episode. I watched it. I wasn't sure what it was going to be like, but it was called, it's on a series on, it's either on Prime or Netflix, called Unexplained, and it mm-hmm. talks about dogs. And that was an amazing, if somebody wants to get some good information, they talk about how the dog uses its nose and sees the world through its nose in a way that anybody can understand it. But when you get down to the hot and cold nose thing, I think too many times those are terms that are just thrown out there and without a full because none of us really fully understand how a dog uses his nose and why he chooses to do certain things and other times he can't.
Yeah, we don't get it. I'll be the first to admit we don't get it, but I think we're getting a better grasp on things because it's hard to understand a sense of another species. Like, we can't understand what eagles and raptors see.
Oh my
god.
Or
turkeys, wild turkeys, how they see.
Did you listen to Seth's podcast a couple weeks ago, and he talked about how birds see? I mean, it's all in, we only see, like, I can't remember what Roy G. Biv, I think, is the, it's red, orange, blue, violet. I can't remember all of them. But we see like six or in the color spectrum. Dogs see.
I only see three.
Yeah.
I mean, as partial color blindness, I can't tell there's between red and green and stuff like that. So
yeah,
the way that a turkey sees just confounds me.
Birds see a few more colors than we do.
Yeah.
You know, and the receptors and the way the eyeball is shaped. A raptor's eyeball is, you know, flatter than a mammal's eyeball. So bang, you know, they're seeing things different, and it's crazy.
Yeah, if I can't get a grasp on that, I can't get a grasp on how a dog smells.
yeah, it's and the only reason, you know, I geek out about it is, and the only reason I have any knowledge about it is because if I didn't study it and I didn't, I had tests on it, you know, If I didn't, I wasn't gonna be certified to run a tracking dog, and it really kind of kicked it in and opened my eyes to how our hounds use their nose and how scent travels and how scent's generated and how it interacts with the ground and bacteria and its environment and how wind affects it and all this other stuff. You know, it's but getting back to the cold nose, hot nose thing, you know, I think that comes to another genetic makeup, and that's its hunt drive, its prey drive, things like that is what causes a dog to react to the scent in different ways than old Fido sitting over here.
Yeah. Well, and prey drive, I mean, that's kind of a loaded term too, because you look at a dog like Bogan, who wants to chase mm-hmm. everything that he can see.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it's a squirrel, rabbit, if Duds is just trotting across the yard, Bogan's going to run over there and tackle him. Anything that's running away from that dog,
yeah.
he instinctively wants to go bite.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's human, animal, whatever. If it's yeah. running from him, he wants to bite it. And that's prey drive.
Yeah.
A bird dog that really quarters well, that's always looking, that's always hustling, and always banging the brush, looking for that next piece of game to fill his nostrils, that's prey drive. But you look at, like, say, Duds is in the yard the other day. I put that video on Facebook, and there's a possum eating pears in my yard, and Duds won't even touch it.
Yeah.
Won't go. He's standing by it when I get there. No inkling to chase that possum. Of course, I've never broke him off possums. You know, I raised the dog. He's 12 years old. I've never had to.
Huh.
But if that possum, or if that was a coon, you know, who knows what I know what he's going to do. He's mm-hmm. going to run it and tree it. He can't help it.
Right.
And so prey drive's selective too. Bogan's not going to trail anything. He's not going to put his nose on the ground and try to run it. Duds is only going to chase coon and deer. That's the only two animals he's ever chased in his life. He's been around hogs, porcupines, you name it. So prey drive.
So if you take, well, he will chase a ball, right, Bogan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he'll fetch a ball like
day,
crazy.
All day long.
All day, every day, yeah.
So if you throw it in the weeds, what does he do?
He looks for it.
Does he?
He does use his nose,
like,
to
insane,
try to find it.
Won't give up?
No, he's going to give up.
Is
you
it?
Know, if he can't see it, you know, after a while, he's going to look for 30, 40 seconds. And if it's hard to find, he's going to go find something else he can see.
One of the things that Ariel Peldunas talked about on Heath's podcast was, you know, how to develop that olfactory sense in dogs, you know, from scatter feeding in the grass to, mm-hmm. you know, doing different stuff, and how that enhances a dog and it trains them even more than they're already naturally wired to do. It wakes those senses up and helps them develop that. And I watched it in this Yogg. I noticed when I got him, he was not nose driven. He was only 5 months old when I got him, I guess, but he was very sight driven, no nose work at all. And I started scatter feeding, you know, just in the grass, and I've seen him develop more of a nose and more of a, like, he hunts mice like a wild man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'll walk around the foundation. We got a lot of rock, native rock. Well, I mean, old rock walls, rock foundations on the barns. Chipmunks love to get between those rocks, man.
Yeah.
And he just runs it through there, and he'll just he'll be running along there, and all of a sudden he'll just do this big scent hook. You know, this just big hook, and just boom, got his nose buried in a hole trying to dig a chipmunk out. So I've watched him develop that. He's in here hunting a mouse right now. But I've seen him do it on coons too. You know, I've seen him walk in there. When I first hunted him, he had no clue. And now when I get to a tree, it's got to be lower hanging tree, you know, lower canopy type stuff. But he'll be standing on his back legs in there, you know, winding because he knows there's a coon up there.
And I think a lot of that is the specific prey. Because you take Jace's squirrel dog, for instance, who trees probably every squirrel by sight. I've never seen the dog tree a slick. He's always got a squirrel. Mm. He timbers well, but he hunts like a hound. He may be 3/4 of a mile in between trees.
Yeah.
And woods full of squirrels. So I know he's only treeing them by sight. I've seen him tree them by sight. But you take that same dog at night, and you drive him around these cornfields here, he'll tree the fire out of coons by scent. Yeah. He'll open on the ground like a hound. He chops, of course, but I mean, he'll open on the ground like a hound and tree and stay treed. And I know he can't see it.
But do you think the squirrel dog might be running through, you know, say he hunts like a hound. So you cut him loose. He gets in there 100 yards, hits this oak flat, boom, all of a sudden there's squirrel scent all around him, stops and starts listening. Cause those are squirrels. When they're climbing that hickory bark, when I could hear him do it.
Yeah.
You know, and now he's zoning in on that, and then he's using that eyesight to pick up just that, boom, that little smidgen of movement and locking in on it, and that's why he's not slick treeing. But I bet you he's using more nose. It amazes me. When I had squirrel dogs, I would sit in tree stands when I was deer hunting and watch squirrels move around, and I thought, how do these dogs ever tree one? You know, it's not like...
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's crazy.
I think a lot of it is the fact that certain dogs like certain game more, and he likes to tree coons more than he trees squirrels. A lot of that has to do, and this is what my original point is, that's where environment plays a big deal, because this dog was running loose and I'm at work. The family's gone during the day. He's 5 months old and he starts treeing squirrels in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
He trees a squirrel at 9 o'clock. What's he going to do for 8 hours, 10 hours before I get home?
Right.
Every time this dog's been coon hunted, every coon he's treed, he's got shot out to him. He stays treed better on a coon. He won't stay treed on a squirrel for very long. Mm. I think a lot of that was just environment. The dog's smart. The dog figured out, you know, if I run these, I get to chew on something. They shoot every one of them out to me. You know, I can trail these up and tree them. They smell. I assume a coon puts out more scent than a squirrel does and lays a better track. So a dog that wants to track, he's one of the rare cur dogs that I think wants to run something that lays a track.
I think, I've run plenty of good squirrel dogs by coon hunting them. You know, I had a female I called Sassy. She's a Brenlin white female. And she actually had some, PKC money one on her. She was a good coon dog. And, she was a good strike dog, believe it or not. That's a crazy thing. That's what really...
Yeah, that sluice is a good strike dog on coons.
Yeah, but I started coon hunting her, and it got to the point where she loved to coon hunt. She would go out, and she would tree squirrels at an acceptable level, but if I wanted to take her to Jamestown to OMCBA or, you know, South Georgia for the Winter Classic, I had to keep her off of coons and just let her get all of her hunting desires and treeing. It had to be on squirrel, you know, focused on that. This is your reward. And I've noticed that with hunting coon hounds and then you bear hunt them. Jazz, now that she's treed a few bear and seen a few bear, she's just kind of hum-de-dum about, you know, she'll go out and she'll tree a coon, but when it comes bear hunting time, it's like, this, I like this.
Yeah. And well, you look at Probate, and that's a dog that won, I don't know, she was a platinum champion and better. And she got down in a country where there's bears and she wouldn't quit treeing bear.
Yeah.
You know, and this was a dog that The times I hunted with her, I'd have just been happy she'd treat anything.
I'd rather have it that way than armadillos.
Yeah.
It seems like you take a dog from up here in our country and you move south into that armadillo country and they just lose their freaking mind.
There's something about lines of dogs too, because I've never had to break a dog off a possum. Ever. Not once in my life have I ever...
That goes against what John Wick says.
Well, I've never had a dog that was... Con has treed two. He's seven now. He hasn't treed one since he was 8 months old. I've never... I corrected him off... Or he's treed three. I'm sorry, he's treed three. He treed one when he was 6.5, 7 months old. I didn't do nothing to him. Just let him off of it and recut him. And then one night, me and Garen Gibson was hunting, and I turned him loose. He trees a possum. I get on to him a little bit and send him on. He goes and trees another possum. And I pulled him off that. He was, I think, 8.5 or 9 months old, and he's never treed one since. He never messed with armadillos, never messed with hogs in Texas. Duds has never treed a possum that I'm aware of. And then, you know, Dollar never treed any, which I got him at a later date. But Delta, Blinken, you know, all the dogs that have run through here, I've never once had a dog that would tree a lot of possums that I kept. I had one female out of Joe Black that would tree a possum, and but she was young. I never broke her. I ended up just selling her as a started pup. But, yeah, it's just for some reason the line that I got or the trader dogs, they've never had any possum trouble.
Yeah. I just,
and that carries on to when we go down south to Texas, they don't mess with armadillos either. Now, the trader stuff with hogs, whew, they love hogs. I mean, love them. And Duds loved running deer, and he still will, probably at 12 years old. I'm guessing if a deer come in and started eating them same pears, I haven't seen any deer in the yard eating pears. And so I think some dogs are just wired to run certain game, and some dogs aren't.
Yeah, Chad Reynolds talked about, I think it was Chad, in the very first podcast he was on. Before he became one of the hosts, he was talking about how, what was he doing? He was trying to hunt deer dogs with coyote dogs in Louisiana or vice versa. I think it was vice versa. I think he was trying to hunt coyote bred dogs on deer.
Yeah.
And, it was deer dogs on coyotes because he shot a deer and it was in the back of his truck. He said they just went ballistic. You know, and he got mediocre performance on them on coyotes.
I don't know if that's ingrained in their DNA or if that's an exposure thing. Because the first thing that we expose a dog to, I think, is going to be their primary game of choice.
I agree with that.
You think of these pups, like right now, we're going to get into puppies here in a little bit, but I've got seven 6.5-week-old pups out here in the puppy pen. Actually, I think they're running loose in the yard right now. But their first game exposure, unless a possum climbs in the kennel with them or something like that, is probably going to be raccoons. And I don't care if, like last night, if their mother comes home with that scent on them, or, you know, that's going to be the first game I expose them to when I'm in the woods in the dark. I think that imprint on a young dog is important. And I think that's one thing that trainers overlook is we imprint on these dogs as their owner, you know, when they're babies. You know, the minute I pick those dogs up and I start feeding them and I start messing with them, that imprints those puppies. Yeah. The same can be said for any kind of game in the chosen game.
I think we spend so much time, you know, trying to figure out what makes us successful or whatever. And so why not spend your time? I'll pick up road kills when I've got a litter of puppies. And, you know, sometimes I just whack the tail off of it and bring it home. And that's the play time, you know, put it on a flirt pole, whip it around in front of them, get them fired up about it, you know, let them chew on it and waller it around. But I don't just let them have it so they, you know, they get bored with it. I take it away from them. But that's their playtime. That's their fun. That's exciting. That's something new. And, you know, I'll do that. I'll do that once a week, maybe twice a week with them when they're real small. And I'm the same way. You know, I'm not a guy that goes out and sets a box trap and if they get them started on possums and switch them over to coon, you know, I want them to be on coon from the first time that they tree to the day they die, if it's going to be a coon dog.
Well, I want my dogs to be specialists.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I don't do multi-purpose dogs other than Jace's squirrel dog. And that was the thing where he wanted a dog he could keep forever. And we'd start these pups and someone would offer me a few $1,000 for them and I'd sell them and they were Jace's pup.
Yeah, no doubt. I've done
you
that.
You know, my grandpa did the same thing to me, but he wanted something. And I thought, well, that'll be fun to have a dog that I don't care what he does.
Right.
You know, if a dog runs a rabbit or a deer or a tree's a possum or a coon, it doesn't matter.
That's why I'm competing with the dog.
Yeah, I'm not competing with the dog, you know, but to be honest, that dog bores me. You know, that he's almost good at something, but he's not really good at anything.
That sounds like all my dogs.
Well, you know, and so I've always been partial to specialists. And yeah. My specialists are something that I want to compete with and or that can compete when they move to a different home or a different handler. And so I don't care if it was when I had retrievers or pointing dogs or whatever, you know, I wanted something that was really good at one thing.
See, and I'm just the opposite. I think the dogs are talented. I think they're skilled. I think they can do a lot of different things and they can do it really good. Now I'm not crazy enough to think that I'm going to take Cajun and, you know, go to Salem, Illinois and win the PKC World Hunt. It's not going to happen. I don't have the desire, but I'm just the opposite. I like a dog that when I go hunting, I don't have to leave a dog at home. You know, I can take what I got and I can go have a good time and not be totally embarrassing, maybe a little frustrated, but not totally embarrassed. And so to me, and there was a time, Josh, and I'm not saying I outgrew it or whatever. I mean, I just, my interest changed. I have all the respect in the world for the, you know, the Joe Mannings and some of the guys that you've interviewed for this podcast that can take a dog and get it to that level of excellence. You know, that's no easy task. I don't care what you're doing with it. But at the same time, man, there's just something about having dogs that are versatile and can hunt multitude of game that I'm really enjoying right now. I really like it.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. And I want everybody to be able to take their dog whenever they go. You know, when I went bear hunting in Wisconsin a couple years ago, I didn't take a dog. I still had a blast. Don't get me wrong. It was fun, but it's different without your own dog out there. Yeah. It's not as fun.
Yeah.
But also, I get, you know, I see these dogs, and these guys had some great dogs, great dudes. I had a blast. We treat a lot of bear. But I'm over here thinking, you know, I can get a dog to do something better than that. I want to get a bear dog, you know, right. A dog that's really good at treeing bears, either, you know, or a pack of them. And so that's not something I'm able to do living here in North Missouri and have the best of the best. And so that's the thing. It's just a mindset thing.
Me too.
You know, when I had retrievers, I wanted to go win the SRS. When I had bird dogs, I wanted to win a shoot to retrieve national championship. You know, when I had beagles, I'd like to go win a world hunt of some kind. And, you know, it's just a mindset thing. And don't get me wrong. I love waterfowl hunting too, but I don't like going without my own dog. But I know when I get that dog that the next thing I'm doing once I get that dog trained is looking for local events.
The thing that's crazy for me is, like, I went through with the retrievers. I haven't had a retriever now for probably 15 years. But, man, I got a whole room full of decoys, and I've still got my parkas and my all that stuff. The only thing I don't really have is the neoprene chest waders. they're trash. But yeah,
I always go hunting somewhere where my hip waders will work that I coon out with.
Yeah, no doubt. But one thing that I've come to realize, you know, there is a difference between the dogs that I have out here and the dogs, like, I'm leaving for Texas and I'm going to hunt with some real hog dogs this week.
Yeah.
And those aren't my dogs. You know, they, it's hard to keep. I like to have, when I show up, I like to have dogs that can get the job done. And I want my dogs. I'm just as prideful about my dogs as anybody else. And I want them to look good. But man, trying to do that when you've got to drive 6 or 7 hours to get to Bear Country, is tough. And I'm going to say it's the dang near impossible when you look at these guys that have got those specialists. What is our job? It's like the old 300 in the movie 300, you know, Spartans, what is your job? You know? And, that's,
yeah, you can't be a potter and a soldier.
No,
you know, it's, and so that's where I'm handcuffed, is because I love going down hog hunting in Texas. I love going bear hunting in Wisconsin. I want to go mountain lion hunting. I haven't got a chance to do it yet. I've got plenty of opportunity. I need to just take the time to do it. But it's not, I have to look at it a different way.
Yep.
I have to look at it as research. I have to look at it as this is a vacation. I can't judge the dogs because I'm not as familiar. You know, I like to think I know dogs, but I'm also not as familiar with the terrain, with the type of game that we're hunting and all that stuff. And so I'm not a professional at it.
Right.
But when I turn a dog loose at night to prepare for a pro classic or something like that, I feel like I am a professional.
Yeah.
You know, I know what's going on. I know what the dog needs to do and how to operate and things like that.
Well, that's an interesting thing too, because I've been with people that don't do anything but bear hunt. And they think they're hauling bear dogs. And I look at them and I'm thinking, the way a dog hunts, the dog behaviors, the characteristics that mm-hmm. we need to see out of coon dogs, or you need to see out of bear dogs, or whatever it is, you know, those natural abilities, a dog man can see those. You know, they can see it. Doesn't matter what it is. So...
I know, but it's hard to go to a different place and look at a guy. And even though I know it's true, be like, well, that dog's junk.
Yeah.
I mean, but you just can't. Yeah, but I can see it.
Man,
you
know? I do too.
And I feel like I don't have the experience to say it. And of course, I wouldn't say it anyway.
Well, you do, though. You do.
I know.
You know, it's just like if you went to the Napwata trials, and say it was a sport protection work deal, and some guy turned this fat Malinois loose that trotted across the field and gummed the sleeve, and you know that that's not what we're looking for.
Exactly.
And it's the same way at different, and it doesn't happen a lot, but sometimes, you know, you get the guys that just like to be there, and they like to have a dog in the hunt, but you know that if their dog is doing something, you're probably not going to drop yours in with them.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, I know exactly what you mean. But at the same time, it still makes it hard to travel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of mountain lions, pal.
Yeah.
We've had some sightings.
Have you been having them in Missouri?
You know how it is. We have them everywhere that there's not mountain lions.
Are they black?
Yeah, a lot of times, yep. Yes.
Remember, but a couple years ago, it was funny when I was working. There were some guys that were posting these pictures of this mountain lion, mm-hmm. and Holton is a little town up here north of me, and it's got some wooded area, but it's mainly agricultural, and. These guys made these black and white flyers and posted them all over Ripley County. It said mountain lion sighted in Holton, and they had the picture of this mountain lion. And look, it was a trail cam picture. And yep. Some guy came running up to my truck. He's like, man, have you seen this picture? This thing was sighted in Holton. And I looked at the picture, and I said, well, that sucker, there must be mule deer in Holton too, because he's dragging a mule deer right now. Either that or he's packing his lunch. He's packed it a long way.
He carried that thing about 1,200 miles.
You know, so you hear all this stuff and you see all this stuff, and my parents are still convinced that there's the old Panthers are still living in Brown County, Indiana. Mm-hmm. It's not just a one-off thing. It's like they're really there.
Well, let's put this rumor to bed, Chris, because there's one hit in Illinois.
Yep.
And we had one in the city limits, a sighting, a legit, it was a mountain lion on a camera in city limits of Indianola, Iowa, just south of Des Moines, mm-hmm. 8 miles. And so there have been some actual legitimate sightings. But during your days as a warden, and I just spoke with, I was on the road working with Joy, and there's a gentleman that runs, he's a wildlife biologist that runs a big WMA in Louisiana around Shreveport. And we were visiting with him. He's got some squirrel dogs. He's a Joy dealer and customer. And so we got to ride around, look at the WMA with stuff, and I was picking his brain as a biologist. And he gets, I don't know how many sightings a year as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in your professional opinion, from your warden days and from your days as a houndsman, how many of the mountain lion sightings, and this is no slight against Brent Reeves, but how many mountain lion sightings that you covered or do you think on average were legitimate out of 100?
Zero. And I've got tons of stories. We actually verified one over in Southwest Indiana, mm-hmm. probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. They're not sure where it came from. I'm not sure what the status is on that anymore. But we used to get these sightings all the time. I remember a guy one time, he's like, calls me and they always call in. They want you to call them back. They just want somebody to talk to, really.
Right.
And it's like, hey, man, I'm seeing a mountain lion. Really? Where are you seeing it? I see it every morning on my way to work. Every morning. I was like, really?
So on day three, they didn't think to maybe like bring a camera?
Yeah. So I was like, man, that's crazy. I said, I know people that are professional outfitters and guides and different things in the course of 30 years. They've seen, you know, two or three from the truck on the road, you know, just driving mm-hmm. down the road and see them. I said, they're super. That is amazing that you saw it. And this guy, I mean, he was dead set. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll meet you down there and we'll look around. And I met him at this intersection and we parked the truck. And I said, where are you seeing that mountain lion? He says, up on that hill. And we stood there for a little bit and it was a yellow lab. Up behind somebody's house. He saw it every day. People would go to work and they'd turn their lab outside and he was in an underground fence and he laid up under the trees and he was a yellow lab. And I made one of my neighbors over here really upset. And it was, it's always unintentional, right? That's true. He called me. He's like, Chris, I got some huge tracks around my cornfield up here. He goes, they're mountain lion tracks. I know they are. I said, really? Mountain lion tracks? Yeah. I said, how big are they? And he told me. I said, they got great big claws. You know, they get big claws at the end of every toe. And, you know, I kind of built it up to him.
Oh, yeah.
It's got big claws. I said, that's a dog. He was just like, quiet on the other end. I mean, offended that I didn't come up and look at his mountain lion tracks that were made by the neighbor's German Shepherd, you know?
Yeah. And there are legitimate mountain lion sightings in Missouri, especially. I'm just going to speak for my state.
I think we're probably gonna see more and more of them too.
Yeah, we will. We will. They're moving in. My friends killed one. They treat it with hounds just 30 miles north of my house. I think it was in 2002. Now, I know that was verified because they brought it to our feed store that we had at the time, and I got a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
They seen it cross the road, turned a bunch of English dogs loose on it, Gary Kleiber, Jesse, Jason Kleiber, all them guys, coon hunters, and they turned a bunch of hounds on it and treated it, shot it with a 30-06. There still is, to this date, no protection on them in Iowa.
Hmm.
So they were perfectly legal in doing it. They got these 127-pound Tom, two-year-old Tom, and he'd probably come from the Black Hills and made a big trip down the river and, you know, ended up in Iowa and a bunch of hillbillies seen him and treat him. And that was the end of him. I think they made a rug out of him.
Right.
And so that's bona fide, verified, you know, and there's been several others. But for the I'm going to just guess offhand, 25 verified mountain lion sightings since 1985. There have been 150,000 or more reports. Oh, yeah.
Reported Easy. Sightings. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's just, and the more we get into, you know, study of wildlife and wildlife biology and different things like that and make discoveries about traditional wildlife corridors and where you're at there, you've got the Missouri River, you got the Mississippi River, you got, you know, all those drainages that are traditional legacy type travel mm-hmm. routes for these animals. So when the populations get to a certain level that it's not comfortable, and we're going to get more of that stuff. And that really speaks to, and it speaks against the animal rights campaign that these big cats are rare and endangered. Yeah. If they were rare and endangered, they wouldn't be looking for new habitat. They wouldn't be looking for new territory. They're trying to expand their range is what's happening here
mm-hmm.
because of the restricted seasons and, you know, we've got an abundance of, I'm not saying we're you're never going to convince a lion hunter that we got too many lions. You're never going to convince a coon hunter that we got too many coons. But we've got a healthy population that's looking to expand its range.
There was actually a wolf, shot in, I think it was 2007 or 8, just about 20 miles south of my house.
Mm-hmm. We have one male shot in northern Indiana.
Yeah, male timber wolf. He was in the 100, and he was huge, but all timber wolves are huge.
Yeah.
A 145-pound dog, 140-pound dog or something like that. And he, guy shot him in his wolf pen just north of Trenton, Missouri, I think in 2008. And I don't know whether he was collared or if they done it through DNA, but he came from a pack in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, these things travel.
Well, most of those, a lion that's collared has DNA on file.
Yeah.
So if, like, the lion that was hit in Illinois, if that comes from they'll take a DNA sample and try to match it to existing DNA samples. So they'll track it back because one of those,
I think that's what they did with this wolf as well.
Yeah, one of those cats up in the Black Hills has been caught and collared and swabbed and, you know, somewhere down the line. So maybe it's great grandmother on its father's side, you know, but they'll have a track back to where it came from. I think it's amazing. And
I do too. But also, you know, on the truth, we ask the tough questions, pal. And I want you to swear on the Bible or whatever. I want a legit number on during your time as a warden, how many black panthers did you drop from helicopters because the insurance agents paid you from Progressive?
Well, all right, swearing on the Bible. We were so busy dropping rattlesnakes from helicopters to control the turkey population that was on the schedule, but we never got it worked in just because, you know, flight time and, you know, just manpower.
Helicopters ain't cheap.
Yeah, I know. And you can only go up for a certain amount of time. One shift, you might get two flights. So when you're dropping hundreds of rattlesnakes from helicopters, it's hard to work in the Black Panther.
Do you guys have any rattlesnakes?
We do. Yeah, we've got some West Central Indiana.
I didn't know that.
South Central Indiana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ours are very localized. We don't have any in our county except for one really small spot. And I've never seen or heard of one north of Highway 136.
Yeah. That's another thing. For years, you know, where I live here right now, I've been here for 30 years. And, of course, we always got the snake calls and different things. And everybody's got a copperhead or a water moccasin or something mm-hmm. like that. And it was always a northern ringneck snake or a band of water snake that they had. But, again, they'd almost want to fight you about it.
Yeah.
I used to have to go to the hospital and do snake ID when somebody came in with a snake bite.
Yeah,
and
even though there was no fang marks,
none.
We have, because as a houndsman that hunts all over the United States, you know, I've I've been from Texas to Minnesota just this year and everywhere in between, you know, especially out east, Nebraska, Kansas, you name it. I have a bad habit of not being scared of any snakes or being snake aware, even mm-hmm. when I'm in a large snake area. When I'm in Louisiana in July, I'm just tromping around through the water like it's no big deal, you know, and I do the same thing in Texas, East Texas and stuff. And everyone's looking at logs and stuff while they're walking over them, and I'm bumbling around through the woods like an idiot. And we don't have it.
Well, I'm the same way. I got to Virginia during the early bear season this year. Well, I hunted there all through the training season too. And then we get to early bear season and show up in camp, and people wearing snake chaps and snake boots. And it's like, crap, I knew I forgot something.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a set of snake boots during the truck going to Texas with me next week. So I am becoming a little more snake aware.
I would be better off. Like, I was down to Louisiana State Youth Championship, and Joy had sponsored that. So I was down there. I was just going to help them judge, and I brought the dog food that we gave and all that stuff. And I never even thought about it. It was hot. It was 85, 90 degrees. It was earlier this spring, early summer, and it was pretty warm. And the game warden came and spoke, and he spoke for like 30 minutes about how to watch for snakes. I was like 25 minutes into this thing. I'm like, oh, crap. I'm going to die over here tonight judging these kids, you know. And so I'm getting better. Joe Manning, me and Joe and Cole were hunting a few weeks ago, and I got a video. I actually put it on my Snapchat that Joe had went across a bunch of water to get a dog, and Joe don't like snakes. He's not a big fan. He looked at the water. Of course, I never thought anything of it at first. And I'm following Joe and Cole to this dog. Goose was treed, you know, just past this water. And Joe goes, oh, no. I said, what? He goes, Mr. No Shoulders should be in here.
He goes,
oh, yeah, snakes.
Yeah.
So I never even thought about it. Joe crossed the water to get the dog. It was pretty deep. It went over his boots. So I stayed on the other side, being the friend that I am. And I looked down not 8 feet from me, and there's a big water moccasin just sitting there slithering through the canary grass and the reeds and everything. And I told Joe, I was like, don't come back over here. But I don't think of it. It's never a thought that even crosses my mind when I'm in snake country, and I need to be more aware.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you the craziest place. You get up to Montana, and I don't know, you think snow and cold, and you know, you don't think about snakes. And we were hunting somewhere, and Michael Ritchie told me, he's like, man, that's a snaky son of a gun in there. You know, talking about the snakes, I guess Council Idaho is just full of them.
Well, I know when we were in Chinook, Montana, doing that job, I actually killed several snakes just right in our driveway of our lodge.
Yeah.
Several prairie rattlers. And it would be 80 one day, 85 one day, and then it would be 30 the next.
I know.
And then them days that they were 85, there were rattlesnakes everywhere.
They just moving.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy. How'd we get on this?
I don't know. But I don't know. We're at an hour. I guess we've talked
Holy
about
crap.
Everything. I just now looked at a recording thing.
Yeah.
But I don't really have nothing crazy. I want to do just kind of a recap of the Saunders episode and, you know, the world hunt we just got finished there.
Well, let me get back to – I'll tell you what my thing on Saunders was. Chris Saunders is one of those guys. He doesn't live too far away from me. I've seen him at several events. I've drawn him – a few times, I wouldn't say several, but a few times. Chris Saunders is one of those guys that he's competitive. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is a competitive person, but the way he plays it, the way, you know, it's just like, hey, you know, things aren't going my way tonight and I'm getting beat here. And it doesn't seem to affect him, you know?
No.
It's, tomorrow night's another night. I'll be here next week. I'll be here the week after that. I'm going to be here. I'm going to have my day. But today's not it. Congratulations. You know, just absolutely straight across the board, probably one of the best people I've ever drawn in a cast.
Well, there's several houndsmen that I enjoy my time with,
mm-hmm.
and whether it be in a cast or whether it be at a clubhouse or whether it be out to dinner. The people that I find interesting or there's not many. I mean, I'm just being honest. There's not a lot of people I find interesting, and Chris Saunders was one of those guys. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed my time with him, you know, on the podcast, but I also enjoy my time with him no matter what we're doing.
What's he do for a living?
Yeah, I don't even know.
Isn't he?
All we do whenever me and Chris are together is talk dogs.
I'm not even going to say, but I think it would surprise you.
Yeah, I know that. Just the way he got into hound hunting was interesting, you know, coming from the Bronx, mm-hmm. self-taught. His family are not huge outdoorsmen like a lot of us. I seen some similarities there. My dad never hunted anything, but I had a grandfather that did. And, you know, so I was only, you know, I skipped a generation, which is pretty common. But the way Chris came into it was interesting. Chris's views on dogs and his knowledge on dogs has always interested me. And he's a good conversationalist.
Yes.
He's just an interesting guy. And I think that came across on the podcast too.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you couldn't tell from the podcast and, you know, Chris Saunders is a black man,
mm-hmm.
and so here's the truth question. Is he interesting because that side of his story? I mean, it's not, when you go south, you'll find a lot more houndsmen who are black. But up in the upper Midwest, it's kind of an anomaly. And did you get into that with him on the podcast?
I didn't get into it with him on the podcast, and I should have, because you're right. I mean, coon hunting is, especially on the competition side, is one of the most inclusive. Hound hunting in general is one of the most inclusive sports there is.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take a lot to get into it. You need a dog and a 2-cell flashlight and the wherewithal. And, right. and Chris has proved that. When you get down south into Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and you think of some of the great Texas, some of the great yeah. African-American coon hunters, you think of, you know, Guy Manning and Sluggo yep. and Mark Gilmore, and all good dudes and fantastic to hunt with and to be around. It's not rare, but I don't know of any other black men that or women that came from where Chris is at and became a houndsman, especially not one that competes at the highest level.
It definitely makes it adds a layer of mystique and interest, mm-hmm. interest to the story.
Yeah,
for sure.
Because we want inner city, urban, northern, southern, east, west, people like that in our community. We want a diverse community. And so the fact that he's here is just a testament to the fact that, you know, it's open to everybody.
Well, we may want that, but the way the human mind works, we're also very tribalistic, and
yeah.
and we put descriptors by, you know, who is a coon hunter. You know, we try to put people, pigeonhole people in different things. And that what you're talking about is like the million-dollar question for the future of wildlife funding, for the future of hunting, for the future of our culture as hunters, is how do we get more people? And they don't have to be a black guy or a black kid from inner city. It could be anybody from the inner city. How do we get them to understand or become interested in hunting? And that's the interesting part to me when I was listening to the podcast, was how he just picked up on this thing through some uncles.
Mm-hmm.
And then once he went to college, then it's, you know, he started hunting and he's like, yeah, this is for me. You know, my son grew up doing this stuff and I have to almost hold a gun on him to get him to go coon
yeah.
hunting. You know, and it's you take somebody from the inner city that grows up totally unfamiliar with it. It just goes back to my philosophy that the reason people mow their lawn and they trim their hedges and they do is because deep down inside, human beings have the instinct and the desire to work the land and care for the land and do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you take this guy that's on his 1/10 acre lot in a subdivision. That's why he's out there weeding the flower beds and trimming the hedges and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And there's something wired into all of us. And Chris Saunders saw that, and he recognized it, and he went for it. I think that's cool, man.
I think it's awesome. And you talk about tribalism, and that tribalism works. It can be a positive, too, because here I am, you know, at a coon hunt with a man with differing views and a different background and a different culture and a different race and a different everything.
Yeah.
And we have that in common that, you know, he's got coonhounds. He must be all right.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm not a big fan of tribalism for the most part, but, you know, you look at that and you look at something that can bring folks together, and, you know, our sport, I think, is probably the most inclusive there is.
I'll tell you, man, we've talked about this multiple times. You know, your football career, some last longer than others. I don't think Brady's ever going to retire. but football careers have a shelf life, or they have an expiration date. You know, the thing about running backs, they say, you know, running backs have so many great runs in them, and then when it's over, it's over. But the thing about hunting, and when we're talking about competing, if you've got a competitive spirit, competition coon hunting, man, you go to the World Hunt, it's not the CrossFit Olympics, you know?
And you look at, we had senior cast this year and had a lot of them. I called them out every night for Roger Dale, and there were six to eight senior casts, and guys that you never would have dreamed would be in senior casts because you've been competing with them, and they're still competing at the highest level. A senior cast, I mean, Jeff Rickliffs and Steve Yant. And
what was the age?
And I don't know, but Jack Bingham was in the senior cast, I believe. I mean, there were senior casts that you'll see at a pro classic every week.
I ran into Rickliffs last Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was, and he was down my way. He was down here playing golf at Rising Sun.
Well, Rickliffs and Strickland invaded our podcast whenever I was sitting down with Saunders. Yeah.
Yeah.
They poked their head in the door and ran their fat mouths like they do.
Yeah.
No, I love those guys. I do. But yeah, it's a great sport, and it's like golf, but better.
Yeah,
you know, this golf, you can play a long time.
It's a
time
life
too.
Sport. You know, that's what that's why we used to talk about it and introduce people to it. You know, when you're going to a school corporation and trying to convince them to put a hunter education class in the schools, you know, you tell it's like, man, this is a life sport. Yeah, you're cross.
I want one thing I do want to talk about, and we're talking about and being inclusive, and we're talking about senior casts and how everything was great and. There, one thing I did want to mention is that there were not nearly enough judges for the Youth World Championship. And the preteens, they had non-hunting judges, but the teens did not. And so here we are, and everybody wants to grow the sport, and everybody wants to do this. And me and Jed have talked about this numerous times, about helping the youth and stuff like that. And we couldn't even get enough judges to show up at the PKC Youth World, and it's getting to the point where I'm afraid we're going to have to start paying them. I mean, we go out there and volunteer. I judge casts. Everybody come out and judge casts that could or that did. I mean, I greatly appreciate it, but there were a lot of guys that could have been out there that didn't show up. And we've got questions in the teen class and panels, and some of these teens are great, and all the kids are great, you know, but they shouldn't have to be out there by themselves at 14 to 18 years old without a non-hunting judge.
Why?
And because there are certain circumstances, and I'm not against it at small events. I'm not. When there's a youth cast at the Bear Creek Classic and they're all, you know, 13 and above, go ahead. Parents are probably with them. Parents are walking along. But this is a world championship.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think there should be hunting judges in the early rounds of the world championship for the grownups. I'm not a fan of it, but the fact that we didn't have enough and that some kids at the age of 14 could have a negative experience at their first, maybe it's their first world hunt, that puts it over the edge for me.
Well, for a guy like me, you know, of course, you know, I wasn't there judging a cast. The kids have a better chance of drawing a raw deal if I'm judging that cast than if one of them.
No,
are judging.
We need qualified judges too.
Yeah,
you know, and it's the same way with the grown-ups.
I mean, would you be opposed to, you know, doing some training time for judges at the World Hunt? That's the problem, because, you know, these kids have got they're going and competing for the world championship. They don't need me that hadn't entered a cast in 4 years to show up and say, yeah, I'll judge for you.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you what they need. They need some of these 21, 22-year-old kids that grew up in that PKC youth program to say, you know what? I need to go back and I need to do my time. So, I mean, how much recruitment is done? How much?
Not enough. There's not enough incentive. There's not enough pushback when they don't come. There's just not enough. And the main thing that I'm getting at here is we got to do better as a community to get things right for all of this, not only just the kids, but the adults as well. There were a lot of complaints, and I'm not going to complain about Roger Dale. Roger Dale done chewed me out for running him down on this podcast too much. As I've said before, RD, if you're listening, I love RD. Roger has always been good to me. I try to help any chance I get, but eventually the wheels are going to fall off if we're not careful. And I just think that we need to do better.
Okay, so here's my – there needs to be more of a structured youth program within these registries than just the World Hunt and just a youth cast. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a culture like 4-H, where you have a youth national committee that helps make some decisions about how youth programs are going to be run. It needs to be deeply ingrained where the kids, we are mentoring kids to be the next generation instead of just hauling them to Salem, putting an adult with them and saying, going out and compete. When you set up those committees committee made up by youth and mentored by adults, and make it a year long thing, and have youth events throughout the year, and you have the panels are youth, the judges are youth, the hunt director is the youth are taking the entries. You're getting an investment at that point. You're getting a buy in, and it's going to mean more to them when they're 21 or 22 or 30, knowing that that's where they came from. And I think they'll come back to it. I think they'll be back, and they'll be like, man, I grew up in that. It's like 4-H, man. My wife, we used to tease her all the time. She, and I did 4-H too. I did do 10 years. I got a 10-year pin, as long as you could. All our kids were 10-year members. My wife was a 10-year member, but my wife was also a 4-H leader, and she helped the kids. And when I was out of 4-H, I was out of 4-H, man. I didn't want to do that anymore. But we used to tease her saying that she was working on her 30-year 4-H pin, you know, because she was just – and you see that at 4-H. You see when you get to the fair, when you get to our fair, you see the same parents that were there. Now they got their grandkids there, and they're still investing their time and that sort of stuff. And that's – I think that's our next natural move to build these youth programs, is to put the ownership back into the kid – on the kids' plates and say, man – what do you guys want? Let's sit down on a committee. This is how you run a committee. This is how you make rules for it. This is how you select locations. You know, all this sort of stuff.
I think it's getting there as parents are getting better about not influence a cast. The kids are getting better about knowing the rules. Mm-hmm. Some of these kids are fantastic handlers already at 15, 16, 17 years old.
I've drawn
some of these little kids got in at the big World Hunt. Mm-hmm. You know, Braxton Wills and I think the Langley kid got in, and a few others that got in with the grown-ups. You know, but there's not enough of those. And we need to take more control as far as building a foundation like you're talking about. It's just like when you're starting a pup, everything starts with a foundation. And to do that correctly, I think we need to kind of step back, look at it, reevaluate and do better. You look at now, Youth Nationals had 55 entries a night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't 100 like we had at Salem,
mm-hmm.
but all the judges were there. All the guides were there. Everything was lined up the way it was supposed to be. The calling of the cast, the getting the kids to the woods, everything was super efficient. But it took, and don't get me wrong, Freiberger does a great job and Amy Thomas does a great job helping out. Steve Yant and myself and Finley, we all worked really hard to make all that stuff happen. But it takes that at every major event. And sometimes we don't start. I mean, we started working on Youth Nationals 6 months before it came about. Mm-hmm. And it feels like the Youth World Championship was, we're going to just run it like we did every other year and hope for the best. And the big show's coming on Monday.
Don't you think it would be cool? I mean, when you were 15 or 16 years old, wouldn't you have liked to have been running for office for the chairman of the Youth National Committee? You know?
Yeah, you know, and I think it would be cool. But also, we got to look around that, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I love kids, but when you're 15 or 16 years old, you're still a dipshit.
Well, yeah, but you. Exactly. You got to have mentors in place.
Exactly.
You know, 4-H.
You know, and 4-H. We got to make sure it's done the right way.
They've got president, secretary, vice president, all that stuff within the clubs. They run the meetings. The adult leader is sitting over here, saying, "Hey, you can't do that. Yes, you can do this. Hey, you want to do this? Have you thought about this? You know."
Yeah.
And you've got to have good mentors in place. Man, I think that's going to be the key. We're hitting some crossroads with this competition coon hunting thing.
We're on the cusp of a lot of different things. We're right on the cusp of.
Just the money purses and mm-hmm. and different things. We're at a crossroads and we have to choose which way we're going here. And if we can build that youth program to be a real deal where the kids have investment in it, we've got our future secured.
Yeah.
For a long time.
And it is getting better. I just don't think it's getting as good as it could be. You know, I think we could do better. Mm-hmm. I really do think that there's still room for improvement, even though there is improvement.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, anyway, I'll tell you what I'd be willing to do, Josh. I would be willing to be involved in helping develop a concept or a model and, you know, either proposing it to whatever registry wants to take it up and go with it.
I don't see why that would be a bad idea.
If we could get a commitment from some people that were willing to come together, but with the end goal, this is key for me, the end goal is to train some of these teenage kids to mm-hmm. be that National Committee for Youth where, you know, you put their names on a ballot and they get elected out of their state to be their state representative. And, you know, the whole nine yards, that's the only way it's going to work is if you make them have the investment in it and not just, you know, loading it, throwing them in a truck and handing them a dog lead and saying, go out and call the dog.
Well, that sounds pretty freaking American, pal.
Yep. And I drink Pendleton whiskey made in America.
There you go. Oregon. I don't know if that's America yet or not. Maybe Eastern
Oregon.
Yeah, it used to be. All right. I ain't got nothing else. You got anything else,
nope.
Chris?
Good one,
all right.
Man.
Yeah, it was a good one. That was a lot of fun.
Yep.
Well, you want to sign it off or you want me to?
This is your show.
All right. Welcome to. I didn't do the pre-intro.
That's because I punched the button before.
I know you hit record while we was talking about stuff we probably should have been talking about. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to The Truth only on the Houndsman XP Podcast Network.